Welcome to our show, Examine Life, on KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
Hello, I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
And this is Examine Life. Plato said that the unexamined life is not worth living, and I happen to agree with him. And tonight we're going to examine, because Pat believes that we've been too serious lately.
And we're going to talk about childhood fantasy and belief. We're coming up to Easter, and we acknowledge that Easter is a serious Christian holiday and celebrating the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But tonight we want to talk about the belief that children have in things like the Easter Bunny.
If there's anything that is one of the most fantastical of the types of traditions we do on religious holidays, it would be Easter, because we have bunnies laying eggs.
And they're colored eggs, often decorated. That's the fun part.
That's right. And some of the really, really rich people in the world have diamond-studded eggs.
Yeah, or those Fabergé eggs. But kids enjoy coloring eggs. How this all got started was the Easter Bunny fetish really started in the 1680s. And that's when the fable started, and it was German. The word that they used for hare got translated into bunny. And it was the creature that came. It knew if you were bad or good, and good kids got Easter eggs.
And the gods and goddesses of fertility happened as a celebration of the vernal equinox, and they used this equinox, and they used the idea of spring nests, which nests have eggs, and eggs are a symbol of fertility. And the goddess of fertility, her symbol was of the rabbit because they're extremely fertile. So if you combine eggs in a nest and that kind of fertility, you're going to have a lot of eggs and a lot of food.
So you get bunnies laying eggs. That's right. How that fable came wrong. The Orthodox would give up eggs during Lent as fasting. And to preserve the eggs that were laid during that time, they boiled them. And sometimes they'd boil them with flower petals or in juices like blueberry or cherry juice that would change the colors of them. And that's where we got started with the decorated eggs.
And of course, you know, you involve kids. And if you're religious parents, then you can take that involvement and talk to them about what the Easter holiday means in terms of your religion. But the eggs are kind of the draw that gets the kids in and gets them involved. And then they're a little bit open to discussion.
Well, the Christian Eastern Orthodox actually colored eggs red with the idea that that the blood that Christ gave on the cross for our sins, and that's why their eggs traditionally were colored red.
And I don't know if you mentioned this or not before, but you were talking about how the reason they boiled the eggs was because they didn't have refrigeration, so the eggs would keep a little bit longer.
That was a way of preserving those eggs that were freshly laid that were not eaten because they were either fasting or giving up eggs for the Lent.
And then, of course, another thing that they didn't consider perhaps back then is if you have kids hunting out for 40 or 50 eggs and they weren't hard-boiled, it would be a whole different kind of fun.
Yes. They decorated them originally. Kids nowadays have an actual basket. I remember as a child going to the park and finding colored Easter eggs in the bushes. But originally they were put in gardening hats or bonnets. And then and that was during the spring season with a small toy. And eventually those gardening hats were replaced with baskets. And that's how we get Easter baskets with bunny laid eggs.
And kids love to carry things around in baskets. So Easter's just fun all the way around. And then there's the tradition, I don't know that all families do it, but the idea of hunting for your basket in the morning. And, you know, we used to play a game where the kids would we'd write notes when they got old enough to read, but we're still believing in Easter. And then each note would tell them to look someplace new, and they'd run all through the house. And I still have a picture I just saw the other day of my middle daughter, and she's proudly holding up her basket, very excited.
I can tell you a story. Long after they knew there was no Easter Bunny, my sons, who were teenagers at the time, I still made Easter basket that had things like swimsuits and flip-flops and, you know, that kind of stuff for spring, summer coming. And I can remember one morning I had totally forgot to make Easter baskets out of what I had gotten. And that morning they came up, and standing next to the bed, I remember awakening him there going, "The Easter Bunny didn't come last night, and we're going back to bed for just a half hour."
And, you know, I don't remember if it was just because I lived in Southern California, but I remember this fetish for years that the Easter baskets were a bucket and a shovel for playing on the beach.
Yes, yes. You can still get buckets instead of Easter baskets.
And I just always wondered, did that start in Southern California on the coast, or what was the deal with? I mean, I know we had sandboxes, but, and by the way, the reason we're discussing this is, it's about a bigger picture of how fantasy is important in a child's life. And I know people want kids to have some kind of realism, and it's good to give them realism, but having some fantasy allows them to have creative ideas. You know, a lot of the great ideas in science and medicine came about as an aha moment because they thought of something that no one else had thought about. And that's where the ability to imagine things that don't make sense actually has a function.
And think about a good example of creativity and imagination is the Tooth Fairy. To different children, it brings a different image. Some of them are ballerinas or princesses. Some of them are even pixies like Tinkerbell. But they use their imagination to create what they consider the Tooth Fairy.
I know my oldest daughter, this about a month ago, I think it was, forgot to put the money under the pillow. And she was feeling horrible about that because her sister had just lost a tooth not too long ago and she got paid. And I said, well, you're probably going to have to tell her, you know, do it the next day and tell the Tooth Fairy, you know, give her some extra money and say, yeah, the Tooth Fairy is so busy she forgot, but she gave you some interest.
One of my grandkids had forgotten to put the tooth underneath their pillow. They had a little pocket mom had made out of fabric that they put their tooth in, and then they put it under their pillow. And they had lost a tooth, and they had totally forgot to put it under their pillow. So my daughter-in-law was so creative, she wrote him a little note saying, where's the tooth?
Yeah.
So that the kids would think, they really knew I lost a tooth.
Oh, yeah. We go to great lengths to trick our kids. I mean, it's almost like, you know, you could make it into an evil story of some of the things we do to keep our kids believing when they ask us rational questions, and we have to come up with an irrational answer that will convince them that, in fact, the unreal does exist.
Well, sometimes even the Easter Bunny got started with the idea that kids, the bunny knew if they were bad or good, and they got rewarded with Easter eggs. The Tooth Fairy is just to soften the blow of losing that tooth, the pain, and how funny you're going to look for a couple of months till a new tooth comes.
Yeah, so we replace the fear of losing a tooth to greed.
Yes. Well, I don't think it's that so much as reward, okay?
Yeah.
It's not greed. They don't know greed yet.
Well, greed is its own reward.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to talk about Santa Claus for just a moment. A lot of people don't realize that Santa Claus is a relatively new creation for our imagination for children.
At least in the current style of Santa Claus.
Right. Santa Claus was legend and folklore. It was always a story about somebody knew that you were bad or good. But it was in 1981 when the cartoonist Thomas Nast depicted him in a cartoon in the paper.
You say 1981 or 1881?
1881, sorry. And shortly after that, the poem came out, A Visit from St. Nicholas, by Clement Clark Moores, who is the fame of
Twas
the Night Before Christmas. But when the cartoon came out, he depicted him as that fat, jovial guy with the full white beard that was totally grandfatherly, you might say. And between the poem and in 1934, the song came out, Santa Claus is Coming to Town, that married the whole image, the whole Santa Claus story, the whole concept of good and evil, you would be rewarded for being good. So it's a relatively new concept of Santa Claus.
And the 1940s is what did it. I wasn't around in the 40s. But I love Coca-Cola came up with their vision of, which was kind of taken from that in the 1940s. And that vision of Christmas, you know, the graphical vision of it just has always stuck in my mind. It's just, I just love that whole, all of the colors and the styles associated with that vision.
Think of all the stories that kids are told, and I think originally it's Mother Goose type stories, but it eventually evolves into fairy tales, and how children just love that that story, that once upon a time story that winds up living happily ever after.
And, you know, I've always been a big reader. I loved reading fairy tales in my teen years because what I read were the original fairy tales. And most of them, I would say a good percentage of them, were designed to scare children into being safe. And we softened them over the decades and the centuries. But, you know, there were many stories. Even think about the story of the three pigs.
Oh,
yeah. I mean, they were going to get eaten. And a lot of other stories. Pinocchio, one of my favorite books, and I read it to my grandson, and he loved it. The original Pinocchio was not a very kind story, and the author actually didn't like little boys. He thought they were conniving, scheming, lazy, and useless. And the story was about Pinocchio acting like a little boy, and there were some, you know, he got hung by the bad guys, the cat and the fox, and, you know, and Disney, who we're going to be talking about later on, brought it into a softer light. But a lot of the tales that are really fun to listen to now, the kids probably enjoyed them, but it scared them. You know, be careful of the big bad wolf, the sky is falling. A lot of them are full of lessons for kids.
Well, even your nursery rhymes, a lot of the stories are really good, happy stories with good endings. It teaches children different things about animals, the tortoise and the hare, that, you know, it's a story about two animals, and just because you're fast doesn't mean you're going to win. Those kinds of stories stick with little kids. And I'm talking little kids 4, 5, 6 years old that aren't really into fairy tales yet, but still those nursery rhymes hold sway with them.
Yeah, Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water, and Jack cracked his head open. He broke his crown.
Yes, but they didn't see it as cracking open his head. That the story was
Jack fell down and broke his crown.
But you know, conceptually, that could be an actual crown that he had resting on his head. So, for a child's imagination, I'm sure he didn't think of, you know, blood oozing out.
Yeah.
But my sons had the Barber the Elephant collection, and there were 4 books in a little box. And I recently came across them, and they were so dog-eared, and I thought, I only raised 2 boys with these books. How could they have gotten so dog-eared?
And it's probably, as we were talking about earlier, the way you read the story. You know, I read to my children, when I would read them these books, I would try to play act and really read with a lot of inflection and emotion and excitement and stare at them like this is really happening. And so they wanted to read those books because they sounded like there was so much going on. So they wanted to learn how to read. And then I noticed my children doing that for their children now, and I do it for my grandchildren, and it gives them a desire to read. And fantasy is a wonderful thing. There's nothing, you're not fooling your kid or creating an airhead or anything. You're giving them the ability to believe in unreasonable things, which later on as a scientist, they might have that aha moment like Einstein did when none of his ideas made any sense. But when you thought it out, it did make sense, and when he applied the math, it worked. But only because he thought completely fantastical thoughts that nobody else agreed to at the time.
And when you read a story to a child, his imagination comes to life because he may have a picture to look at in that book with you, but the activity that you're reading to him that character is performing, he actually creates in his mind. So his creativity and his imagination are activated.
Yes, I you know, remember how popular radio was before we were born as well. And I think it was like reading for a child. They didn't have to read the words, but they didn't have a visual picture. So they had to make up their own picture. So they were using their creative muscle when they listened to radio. When they're watching TV or nowadays playing video games, everything is created for them and they're just reacting.
And the storyline, and I know even now as an adult listening to, there's stations that have the old radio shows on.
Mm-hmm. And I listen to them still.
Yeah, and it's interesting if you're with someone and you're talking about the storyline and the character, and you describe what you think that character looks like, and it's totally different than what they think that character looks like.
That's right. And you know, when we played with toys, you know, we used to play with toy soldiers. And you had to create scenarios and create battles and create wars. And you had to, you know, when kids play outside, it's fun to listen to kids making up a game and making up rules and regulations and how to play the game. That's all creative juices. that when a kid sits and plays a video game, there are very few games that actually stimulate that. Most of them, you're just reacting. It's not that video games are evil. I think they just need to have them as a part of their life, not the whole thing. But books and old radio and telling your kids stories, they have to imagine. And that's a muscle that you have to use.
And that not only creates imagination and creativity, but you're spending personal time with them that your focus is on them. And they know that.
And you're experiencing it together. I can remember, you know, turning and looking at them with wide eyes when I'd read a particular part of a story, like, wow, that really happened. And you're just doing it together.
And they know it, and they feel a part of it, like you're, I don't know, giving them a special gift, a secret somehow that you're sharing.
And, you know, some of the more fantastical things, like when I was growing up, it was the comic books, you know, just loved the superhero comic books and the way that those heroes made you feel. You know, if you were a little boy, you had, you know, Batman and Superman. Superman had powers, and he was kind of invincible except for kryptonite, but Batman created his powers, and that gave you the belief that you could do what he did. You know, you couldn't be a Superman, but you could become a Batman, at least in your own mind, and Iron Man was the same way. He built his suit, and he didn't have superpowers, but he created them from himself, and little girls had Wonder Woman, who did have special powers. But a lot of her powers came from the fact that she was born an Amazon. She was very strong and strong-willed, and yet her alter ego, like Clark Kent, was this mild-mannered woman who worked as a secretary for an Air Force officer, very, you know, demure. But when she was Wonder Woman, get out of her way.
Well, I think that was the point of a lot of the even nursery rhymes. It taught children circumstances where an animal or a figure in the book overcame obstacles in their life. They overcame challenges. Even the story of Bambi, where mom dies in the book. I mean, in the story. That happens in real life to children, and it gave them a way to deal with disappointment, and people say, well, you know, when they find out there's no Santa Claus or no Tooth Fairy, it's really traumatic. No, it's not. Usually by time they're old enough, another sibling or friend tells them, and they rationalize, right, that, you know, I really should have realized this before. But they don't have this horrific disappointment in their life. And if they do, they have to learn to deal with disappointment sometime in their life.
And you know, I can remember, of course, being a fan of science fiction growing up. My mind was particularly warped. But I can remember, as I learned about quantum physics and things like that, kind of putting together all the science of the time and saying, you know, there could really be a guy who could deliver a whole bunch of toys in a one-hour period. You know, one day a year, theoretically, with the speed of light and time dilation, it could happen. And it keeps your mind open. And as I said, Einstein's ideas at the time didn't make sense to the established scientific world. But they were true, nonetheless. But he pulled them out of you know, just wild thoughts.
Well, think about a lot of the movies we go to now. From the horror movies to the science fiction movies to even some of the comedies. You have to suspend reality to go into the theater and accept what you're seeing because of Hollywood special effects and stunt people. So you as an adult are fantasizing. You are using your imagination and creativity and suspending the limits of reality when you go in that theater.
And you know, it's funny, you'll talk to people and you'll, in part of a discussion, you'll say, oh, it's just a movie. I realize it's just a movie. And yet you're talking about the person like, why did they do that? That's not what they should have done. And you're totally bought into this thing, but you want to pretend like you're not escaping.
And think about children. They do the same thing with these storybooks, the nursery rhymes, the cartoon characters. They are inserting themselves somewhere subconsciously as I might do this or I would have done that. Even some of the video games that the kids have now where they build their own home and they have their own pets and they dress their pets and all of this other stuff, it's their imagination that they're actually using to create an alter environment that they can maybe escape to when stress gets too much.
They're using that creative muscle. Cartoons for me, a little bit of lack of supervision growing up, cartoons for me were I mean, the Warner Brothers cartoons, I can't say enough about. At 63, I still have a picture of Bugs Bunny shooting pool on my wall. I mean, if you watch those cartoons of those days, they really gave you thoughtful presentations of the different human personality types: the bully, the trickster, the ne'er-do-well. The, you know, Bugs Bunny was never really got upset about anything. And he pretty much let his enemies who were trying to hurt him hurt themselves, and sometimes he helped them along a little bit. But he was never vindictive towards anyone. And then you had Yosemite Sam, who was always angry all the time, wanted to hurt everybody, but he always lost.
Well, even if you go back to small children, before we got into the cartoons of 7, 8, 9-year-olds, little children, look at how Barney the dinosaur, I can remember how many women and dads hated that purple dinosaur.
Oh, I couldn't stand him.
I know, but he was real to those kids. Big Bird, the Muppets, all of those taught children, and they drank that knowledge. They wanted to learn their alphabet. They could sing that song that taught them the alphabet or numbers or shapes or colors. They were thirsty for knowledge, and these creative animals taught that to them.
And you know, it's interesting. You think of the Muppets and you think of children, you know, believing in these little puppet characters. But if you look at what I forget
Miss
what
Miss Piggy and Froggy.
Well, well, those too, but I'm thinking of Jim Henson in general. Science fiction movies later on, a lot of those were created by the same creators of the Muppets, and those adults were enjoying.
Well, the Muppets had a lot of adult humor in them.
They did, as they evolved, like you said, Miss Piggy and Kermit.
But, well, even the Cookie Monster, I think, was designed to appeal to children, but after a while it appealed to adults. But your Big Birds, your Sesame Street was all about teaching children. And it was like, you know, in the middle of the afternoon that kids could, when they're supposed to be trying to go to take a nap, or when they just woke up from a nap, it was the perfect learning environment for them.
Yeah, they had the count.
Yes. But it was a part of the growing up process for children, was to have them exposed to those shows. Even, you know, Barney, as he became older, I don't even know if Barney's still on, but I can remember Captain Kangaroo and Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers made you believe your neighborhood was safe and where to go and how to get around it. Captain Kangaroo taught you about all kinds of things, from dirt to, you know, animals to the environment, even in some aspects.
And then later on, as I was talking to you before, the neighborhood that I came from, Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live did his own version of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which is probably my favorite. And we had a character called Sheriff John, who was in Southern California when I was a kid, and he had a stop-and-go game. He had a traffic light in his set, and you were supposed to drink your milk on the green light and stop on the red light. I don't think he did the yellow light.
Did he do vegetables?
Nope, just milk, as I recall. And then everybody knows Bozo, but we had Chucko the birthday clown.
Yes, I remember Chuckles. Yeah. And Bozo, and the generations before us had the Little Rascals, you know, and the dog with the one black eye and the one white eye.
Yeah.
So every generation has something to hang on to that is not necessarily a cartoon, but it is that source of entertainment that normally had a story behind it that was good and evil, or good is, you know, achieves over bad. Even if you think back on the early Westerns, Gene Autry Westerns, and those were all based on good and bad.
And they always did it by being brave, which, you know, in those days, the idea was if there was a bully, you were supposed to stand up to them. And now, if you stand up to the bully, you likely will get ejected from school as well.
Well, times have changed so much, and that movie, I think it was the 210 Train to Yuma or something like that. I really resented that movie, that evil won. I thought, that's awful. Why do we have to change that concept that good prevails over evil? But
well,
Hollywood can't resist.
It's an idea of realism. They wanted to make their movies more real.
But that's why we go to the movies, is to escape reality. We get plenty of that every day. That's the beauty of the story that has a good, happy ending.
I agree. You're listening to KKRN 88.5 in Bella Vista at Round Mountain. And we're community-supported radio, and you out there are the community, so please support your station. And at the same time, give your opinion about what you'd like to hear on the station. There's music that you won't hear anywhere else. The talk, I can't say much about that, but they have a wide variety on your station. Support your local station. We're going to take a little bit of a break. I'm Steve.
I'm Pat.
And this is Examine Life. This first 25 minutes has gone pretty quickly for me.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on.
Join the discussion. KKRN boasts a variety of talk radio, both from local and syndicated sources. We want to stimulate thoughtful and meaningful conversation. KKRN can offer more real conversation because we are supported by listeners. You have a voice.
Make them believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live.
The infinite possibilities of music are showcased by the eclectic panorama of song styles that you can find on KKRN Radio. You won't find our musical explorations on more mainstream commercially driven stations. From classic country to new age, from classic folk to classic rock, from blues to jazz, and music from outside our country. You'll find it all on KKRN listener-supported radio, radio that makes you listen.
I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. Oh, give me lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Oh, give me what you alone can give, a kiss to build a dream on.
You're listening to KKRN 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
And this is Examine Life. We've been talking about fantasy because we're coming up on Easter, which is admittedly, it is a religious holiday, but, you know, they all have their kind of the fantasies. You know, Christmas has Santa Claus and all of that. And Easter has the Easter Bunny, which is completely incongruous, but we all do it. Or not all of us, I'm sure, but a lot of us do it. You know, some people have particular concerns, and so they do artificial eggs or whatever. But
yes,
you know. But in general, it's a bunny that lays eggs. So that's
yes.
If that's not fantasy, there is no such thing.
Well, I think if you think about Walt Disney is a prime example of someone who converted fantasy into a reality in his Disneyland theme parks. And he really wanted to create the happiest place on earth. And it all started with cartoons. He was a young man who started out with 7-minute fairy tales on film. And that was when he was in his early 20s. But by 1923, he had his own studio, and that's where he really started. It was the only studio dedicated to cartoons and make-believe.
And he wanted to bring fantasy to life. And, you know, he created new forms of animation. He created the first three-dimensional cartoon where you could see depth with this giant vertical camera that was like a tower that they had to shine down through several plates of glass. And he wanted to bring fantasy to life, which is a good desire to do, but what happens with human society is we always carry things too far. And now, you know, through video games and certain TV programs and so on, fantasy is so much brought to life that there's no imagination anymore. It's all in front of you.
Well,
but it was a good idea to want to bring fantasy to life because he wanted kids to say, oh, it is real. You know, here's the Easter Bunny right here in front of me, so it must be real.
Well, he wanted to keep it as like a cartoon character. Even when you went to Disneyland, there was a life-size Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse. These were part of the fantasy, but they were reality. The kids could go and have their picture taken with them, and it was a fabulous experience for that child. But think about back in the 1920s when he invented Mickey Mouse.
I remember you talk about the life-size characters, and we went to Disneyland. It might have been the first time we went, and my one of my daughters was still pretty young. And we were leaving. It was the end of a long, tiring day at Disneyland. And we were walking out, and there were some characters out there sending us off on our merry way. And my one daughter was looking at me and talking to me, and the big bad wolf was right behind her. And she turned around and just a blood-curdling screech. And she loves animals. She's a big savior of animals and rescues and so on. But those teeth... I remember for a long time, dog's teeth were really intimidating to her because he was right in her face. He was bending down to say hello, and she turned around, and there were those teeth inches from her.
And poor Big Bad Wolf, he did.
Yeah, he didn't mean to do that.
But, you know, in 1929 came along, Mickey Mouse was the voice of Walt Disney. He put his voice in his place. I think Steamboat Willie, I think, was one of his, the first of the movies that he made.
I think it was the
Mickey
first
Mouse.
Mickey Mouse cartoon.
Yeah, and then they came Minnie and Donald and Goofy and Pluto. Those were the original five cartoons that most everything was centered around in his studio for a long time.
And, you know, I didn't know Pete was a cat until I was an adult.
Really? Think about how many of those characters, the Huey, Dewey, and Louie,
yeah.
You know, the little ducks. For years, when you were little, if you saw three ducks, it was Huey, Dewey, and Louie.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and I, you know, there's one program that I used to love, Mickey's Father's Day. And it had Goofy and different characters, and it was about fathers. And, you know, he went through dieting, you know, becoming middle-aged and gaining weight, went through smoking. I kind of went through all those stages, too. And I loved that it was about three different programs all wrapped into one. And I've wanted to get it all these years, but you know, if to buy that anywhere, it's hundreds of dollars because they don't produce it anymore.
Oh, I bet.
I mean, it's literally hundreds of dollars to buy just a DVD of that.
Think of what it would be worth if you had one of those e-tickets. Because when we went to Disneyland, when it originally opened, or shortly thereafter, I think it opened in the 1950s, but they still had the little paper books, and the e-ticket was the, you know, fast, really expensive ride.
Yeah, it was wonderful going there the first time when I was young. The Pirates of the Caribbean had just come out, and the moon ride wasn't that impressive, but it did get to be better later on.
Well, it all started in 1933 with his first Oscar, and it was for the film Flowers and Trees, which was nothing more than a fairy tale. And then the big hit was really Snow White during the Depression. It was the first movie ever to make $1.5 million, and it was a cartoon. And they took cartoons serious after that.
And one of their a lot of cartoons fashioned themselves after the Disney cartoons later. And then they made a real breakthrough when they did visual animations to classical music in Fantasia. I mean, that hadn't been done before that I can recall. And some of the Warner Brothers cartoons, maybe shorts of similar things, but most of those were copies of what he did with Fantasia. And I can remember that it gave the music a whole new depth.
And the songs that came out with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and all of his movies and themes, every kid could sing those songs.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just part of life was the songs. And then he had that TV show on Sunday nights with Jiminy Cricket. And that was another thing. Every child had to stay up long enough to watch the Walt Disney show.
And when you think about it, reading about his life and seeing movies about his biography and so on, he was one of those lucky people like Einstein, I guess, who was allowed by the people he chose to be around him. He was allowed to be a fantasy maker. He didn't have to be as businesslike, and many times he came close to destruction because he was more oriented towards fantasy. He just wanted these dreams to come true, but he surrounded himself with the kind of people that eventually enabled him to do that so he could be what he wanted to be.
Well, he also shared his passion with his brother Roy and his wife, who was, she drew. So having the commonality, the common interest, and the common passion, and the people they brought into their studio had that same passion for cartoon and fantasy and telling a story that was directed for children, even though sometimes they'd have adult connotations to them. They wanted to take the fantasy to the child, and it was fantastic.
Those Warner Brothers cartoons, you know, I'll never forget those. When my grandchildren come to visit, they don't want to see the new cartoons. They want to see my unedited, uncut Warner Brothers cartoons. And you know what? They're not violent because of them. But, you know, those cartoons, Bugs Bunny, Yosemite Sam, Porky Pig, even some of the non-labeled characters like the dogs that they used to have on and different cats other than Sylvester, they all had human, very human-like traits. And I personally learned a lot about people. Those writers of those cartoons had very good insight into different personalities. And, you know, Bugs Bunny always won, but he didn't win by being lazy or because there's, you know, right will always win. He won because he was smart. He was smarter than his opponent. And so he didn't have to be violent.
And he never was, never hurt anyone.
No.
And there never was blood on those cartoons.
Yeah, there was a lot of bumps and, you know, heads sticking up, but
no,
there
blood.
Were any blood.
Never any blood.
Because blood was too hard to look at.
Yes. And it was okay to have Bugs Bunny walk on 2 feet, like Pluto, the dog that walked on 2 feet. It was okay to have that sort of character, or to have a cat that was pink striped with polka dots or something. It was okay in cartoons.
And it was okay to have the coyote draw a tunnel in a rock and then have the roadrunner be able to go through it.
Yes, it was acceptable. And that really, I think that's the part of the creativity and the imagination that kids just love.
And that's how many of our major discoveries happen. They happen because people's minds were open to ideas, you know, Einstein with relativity. The idea that light traveled at a constant speed, but time did not, was just anathema, and they said he was crazy, and who are you to come up with this idea? But they couldn't refute it because in the end it was right. But he had to pull that out of the air. That didn't make intuitive sense, and it didn't fit with current science at all.
And cartoons don't fit with science. And people say, well, they're violent. But they're the kind of violence that is suspended from reality because the character cannot possibly be real in cartoons. So neither could the violence. Neither could the cartoon always came back to life in the next episode. So it was okay that they could suspend their reality to absorb themselves in this creativity.
And the people that I grew up with, some of them grew up violent, some of them grew up completely anti-violent, and they all watched the same cartoons. You know, I don't think people who don't want kids to have any violence at all in their life, in the things that they see, I don't think have enough faith in the kids.
No, and a lot of it has to do with, you know, nurturing and how you are raised. The cartoon's not going to change your life for the better or for the worse. If anything, it might allow you to suspend the stress that you have in your life, even as a child, into escape into this fantasy or the cartoon. I can remember going to the movies as a kid, and you had two feature movies, and in between, they put a cartoon. And it was like, oh, you can't go get popcorn now. The best part's coming on, this two-minute cartoon.
I remember those days. And in the comic books of the time growing up, you know, you had You had superheroes that, you know, Superman, you had to suspend belief quite a bit because he was invulnerable and he could fly and all that.
And who ever heard of kryptonite, really?
Right. Well, there's actually five types of kryptonite, and geeks like me know that. But Batman, on the other hand, you could believe in that because he created everything. He was just an ordinary human being, but he used his wits.
Had a cool car, too.
Yeah, and he built the car and his force of character to become what he was. And Iron Man did the same thing. So those were people that could inspire young men. And you know, people like Wonder Woman, again, she had special powers to a certain degree, like her magic lasso, where if she lassoed you with it, you had to do whatever she told you. But her biggest strength was her personality, which came from her being an Amazon. And that wasn't anything magical. It was just this island full of women, according to the comic books, that just were real strong people.
And they allowed different to be okay. So these characters were different. They weren't like everyone else. So it was okay for children to be different. They didn't have to be like everyone else. It gave them permission. It was okay to be different if you wanted to be different.
And that's what gives us our variety in life. And again, the new ideas that sometimes turn out to be wonderful things are because somebody is able to suspend belief long enough to think something completely outlandish, but then find a way to make that thing or something very similar to it possible and enrich our lives because they have an open mind. I know a lot of real staid people say, well, if you have an open mind, you can pour anything into it. But it's not like that.
Especially with cartoons and make-believe. The idea of even Batman, Superman, Incredible Hulk, all of them were good over evil.
Right.
It was no matter how distorted they looked, like the Hulk was green and ugly, but he represented good. So you didn't have to be perfect to be good. You could be good even though you looked funny.
And they, you know, a lot of young preteens and teenagers read the comics of those days, and you know, Superman, Batman, the DC heroes, everything was mostly about their hero battles and so on, where Marvel Comics had these characters that always had these torturous personal lives and all these issues that just strained them to no end to that gave them the character they had. And so you did learn a lot about emotions and about people by reading those comic books. It wasn't all just fantasy and fun. It taught you about people. And of course, everybody reacted to those things in different ways, but they I think, created a generation, and they were helpful and for the most part.
And think about all of the fiction books that were really popular, like A Thousand Leagues Under the Sea and a lot of these other things that allowed children's imagination, before the movies ever came out, about these very same stories. But it allowed them to look beyond what was reality. And that this fantasy, that this came from someone else's imagination, just took them over. They'd get absorbed in those books.
Oh, yeah, the Arabian Nights and Treasure Island was a big favorite of kids. The original Pinocchio was a story for children. It was a little harsh, but, you know, a lot of things were back in those days. The stories that kids read were pretty harsh, but life was harsher then, too.
Well, I think as time, especially with the introduction of Walt Disney and his Once Upon a Time fairy tales, that we got to where we softened the idea, but yet we allowed the reality of, you know, Sylvester the cat always chasing the mouse, even though the mouse is always going to get away. It was still the idea that somebody is always chasing someone else, someone is always trying to get away, so that it was okay to be a part of that. And when you talked about emotions in the Marvel comics, it taught children to pick out personalities in their life and identify with, okay, that person is similar to this person, and this is how you might react. It helps them cope with the people that are in their lives.
Yeah, and it gives them tools to cope. I mean, the writers were intelligent people, and they knew what they were doing. And even Warner Brothers cartoons, they understand human personalities very well. They exaggerated all of them. They were all there, you know, Pepe Le Pew. I get a kick out of the subtleties of these cartoons. In Pepe Le Pew, they never talk about him being a lady killer, but they make him a skunk. And back in those days, women used to call those kind of men stinkers. And so they made him a skunk, but they never said the word stinky, stinker or lady killer, anything like that. They just if you lived back in those days, you knew what it was. And I'm a fan of history, so I know what it was. But they always use these terms. You know, Bugs Bunny, back in World War II, they had these things called gremlins, which would, you know, when a mechanic did everything he could to an airplane, but it still crashed, they'd blame it on the gremlins. Well, in Bugs Bunny, they actually showed you a gremlin and what they do. And, you know, the concept of air brakes, when his airplane's just about to crash into the ground and he remembers that it has air brakes, and so he hits the air brakes and it stops a foot from the ground. And they were just wonderful to watch. They made you laugh, and even when you were a kid, you could see how ridiculous they are, but you enjoyed them.
Some of the modern movies that are cartoonish, you might say, one comes to mind, which is Monsters, Inc., mm-hmm. where the monsters, the little girl, they try and help her understand there really isn't anyone under the bed or whatever the monster is that she's developed in her mind. I thought that was a marvelous movie for children to see how the boogeyman concept, how many adults have had kids want you to leave the light on or look in the closet or look somewhere because they believe there's someone else in the room that's going to get them after dark.
And some of the best movies will show you, yes, there are monsters there, but they're not always bad things. Even a movie like that shows you that there could be such things as monsters, but just because they're monsters, they have to be bad.
That's right, and they don't have to get you. They can be there to protect you. So the spin on those kind of movies I always enjoy. Even the Toy Story movies, where the toys come to life when the guy is gone.
Yeah.
It really feeds to the imagination of the child. Okay, I have these toys that I have to make do with making them talk or move, but they might do it when I'm not there.
Yeah, when I'm asleep, what do they do? Or when I'm gone, what do they do?
It's like your dog, you know? What does he do all day when I'm gone? And people put up these cameras and find out these weird things that their animals do when they're gone all day.
And if you're a particularly open-minded kid, when you come home, you're kind of trying to sneak up on your toys and see if they're doing any of that when they're not looking.
And really, think about things as simple as matchbox cars. When they just had this, I mean, four-year-olds can handle these cars, and they became a craze because children could use their imagination to make them go as fast as they wanted.
Oh, yeah. You could. That was the thing. When a child doesn't have all the best toys, they'll create the fantasy because we're naturally a creative species. Not all of us, but many of us are. And you know, you think about the kid that doesn't have as many toys as the rich kid, but in fact, they have just as much fun until they find out the rich kid has more than they do or somebody tells them that, and then they're kind of unhappy with what they have. But up until then, they've been perfectly happy because they're creating, and that creativity stays with them for life. It wanes as they get older unless they feed it.
And before the big box giant toy stores came along, kids still had chalk and jump ropes and jacks and toy cars. They might have been wooden, but they had erector sets. They had these things to create with, and they would create an alter world. Turn five kids loose in a sandbox with a hose and see what happens. They're out there for hours.
Yeah. And all that's about creativity, because there's you just naturally want to have it be more rich, and so they create it on their own. It's fun to sit and listen to kids outside making up a game.
Yes, or even allowing them. I can remember when my son was maybe three, setting out a giant jar for sun tea and him looking, watching the water turn colors. He was fascinated by this process, but it stimulated his thinking, his imagination. Like, what's going on? The water's turning a color.
Yeah, it's just a natural thing. Humans need to create something out of nothing, and they need their world to be richer, so they try to make it richer. And, you know, sometimes that gets warped with drugs. You know, people try to make their lives richer with drugs because maybe they don't have work or they're being allowed not to work, and so they create artificial way.
They need an escape, and it's a form of fantasy. And same with children. They may have the need for an escape if they live in a home that is not positive reinforcing for them. And books, cartoons, these are things that allow them to escape.
And having somewhat of that kind of a life as a child, you know, Bugs Bunny and Wile E. Coyote and all those people raised me, and I learned a lot of philosophy about life from them, and it gave me, I think, a positive attitude that a lot of things were possible, and that, you know, people that had bad ideas could be overcome, and it wasn't just a natural thing. You had to work at it. You know, and if there's one person who's an optimist, it's that Wile E. Coyote. He never gives up, and every time he comes up with a new idea, he knows it's going to work. No matter how many failures he's had.
Try and try again. It's a lesson that very subtly is taught to children. And most children never outgrow cartoons. I know some people that are in their 40s that still love to watch cartoons.
Oh, I do, especially those old cartoons and certain new ones. But, you know, there are probably adults out here that will tell you that the Roadrunner program was a bad thing to watch because this evil coyote was always trying to do horrible things to this roadrunner. But what I learned from it was that there are people out there who will constantly be happily enthused no matter how many times they fail or get smashed or anything else. His next plan was going to work. He just knew it.
Optimism.
Yeah, and that's what I took away from it. Rather than, you know, good, he's going to smash that roadrunner, I just took from it that, you know, you learn from him, just never give up, because it's the struggle that matters.
And think about Sylvester the cat and Tweety Bird. You know, I believe his name was Jones, Chuck Jones, who invented that cartoon.
He was a producer, I think.
Yeah.
Or director.
And he believed that you never hurt Tweety Bird. So it was, no matter what the cartoon was, Tweety Bird always got away. And in real life, obviously, cats catch birds, but in the cartoon, it allowed children to believe that the bird would always get away and win.
You know, we excuse me, when my kids were growing up, we had this cat. He actually didn't live long. We were a little late with the pills, and he got heartworms, but he lived to probably, he was an adult for a while, and he was he was just like Sylvester in that if he would lay sometimes on a porch or anything with stairs on it, he would actually flow down the stairs. He would roll over just like Sylvester would do when he got knocked out. And when his name was Sylvester. We named him Sylvester. And he looked like him. He was black and white. And he just looked like the cartoon cat and acted like him.
And I think that Hollywood sometimes misses the whole point of the cartoon and the beauty of the story in its original form. When they try and recreate it, sometimes something's lost when Hollywood goes off the deep end, which they often do with remakes of cartoons.
Well, I think what they try to do is the things that you have to imagine in the film, they try to create those for you. And they don't seem to realize that it's that very creativity that you have to use to watch the film that makes it so enjoyable.
And I think a prime example of that was in the Looney Tunes movie that they tried to remake regarding, I think it was Sylvester and Tweety Bird, Space Jam, where they actually slammed the bird in the movie. And it's like, no, the whole point of the movie is that bird never gets touched.
Right.
And Hollywood lost that.
The bird's kind of got the Bugs Bunny attitude, you know, that I'm not out to hurt anybody at all. And, you know, every time the cat gets smashed, the bird's like, whoops, poor putty tat. You know, he's the innocent guy, and the cat's the bad guy, and that's the way it has to be. The cartoons are very well defined as to who is who. Some of the characters, just to this day, I just, it's hysterical when you watch them.
And think about the adult slapstick that was made for our adult entertainment. Laurel and Hardy is a prime example of slapstick that is, you suspend your reality belief with the stupid things they did to each other. And the Three Stooges. I mean, this is nothing more than adult cartoons on a reality level.
Oh, yeah. And Abbott and Costello, who's on first?
Oh, yeah.
It's still pretty funny when you listen to it today.
And those were things that adults were made for adults, and adults appreciated it. They thrived on it.
And, it, you know, humor is kind of a stress reliever. If you look at what people laugh at, people, some will say, well, gosh, you know, humans are pretty bad. We laugh at people's discomfiture. But I think it's a stress reliever. That's why humor usually takes on the form of somebody being beat up or tripping and falling or something bad happening to them, and we laugh at it. we're laughing because we know it's not real. And we're laughing, I think, as a stress reliever. I think it evolved that way. If you could laugh at harmful things, you just felt better. Everything felt better. It was a positive outcome.
Well, they say a belly laugh releases endorphins in your body that give you a sense of high. They're kind of like a happiness reaction. And even if, like the funniest home videos, you see there things there that you know could easily happen to you because you may have done something just a slightly different and didn't have that funny consequence, but you know how close you've come to doing those exact same goofy things.
There, but for the grace of God, go I.
And how funny it is because you can identify with it. Or someone who you see has experiencing something, you have experienced the same thing in your life, and you know how frustrating it was, and you just have to bust up laughing about it.
You know, most people think Alan Funt started that with Candid Camera, but it was actually, there was a program called Candid Microphone back in the radio days.
Oh.
Where they did the same kind of thing.
And I think they've tried to bring back Candid Camera, but it's not exactly the same, but it is funny. People just do goofy things.
You know, it's what they do now with it. I think the latest program was one where they put people in situations that are kind of uncomfortable, like they'll make it a racial situation and try to see what people are going to do in that kind of thing. So they are trying to make it too serious, you know, make it all about social issues. And fantasy is supposed to be about having fun and about having your mind expanded, the ability to take in ideas that don't make common sense but might in fact turn out to be something wonderful when you take the parts of them that do make sense.
And I don't want a political message in my cartoon or my fairy tale. I'm sorry. I really don't want. And a lot of what Hollywood produces, even though it's supposed to be comedy or it's a cartoon or whatever, if at the end they always have to insert some sort of political message. And it's like, why? It was funny without that.
It's true. And they did some of that with Warner Brothers cartoons in the 1940s during the war. But, you know, there were people detracting and people who were against the war, but most people actually enjoyed those cartoons because they were all for America. And so I'm not saying that was good or bad. I'm saying so it worked to some degree. They didn't do a lot of that, but they had, you know, they saluted the military and the U.S. and so on.
But we as a nation had a commonality about that war that was different than any other war since then. And I think that's part of that. Even if you go back and look at the movies, the patriotic theme behind the movie was very strong, where I don't think war movies today have that same patriotic theme, except maybe that's what it made American Sniper so popular.
Yeah, some of them do. Hollywood's good at praising America when it's going to make them some money. The thing about the World War II cartoons was they were still funny. As evil as Hitler was, they made fun of him.
Yes, they did. And it's amazing how a good cartoonist, even a political satire cartoon in the newspaper or in a magazine right now, can be hilarious because it doesn't have to be politically correct. It is just funny. And when you think about the funniness of it and the irony sometimes, that it just overpowers any of the politics. It's a belly laugh.
Some of the news stations you watch today are so careful to be politically correct that they look afraid. And some of the ones that aren't afraid to be politically correct are having fun. And they're still telling you the news and they're giving you the honest news. And people need to lighten up and enjoy life a little more. And that's really what our program's about tonight is, you know, the whole idea of Easter and bunnies laying eggs, you know what? Enjoy it. Have fun with it.
Absolutely. Do the Easter basket thing. Even if it is nothing more than coloring eggs for your own home, you'd be surprised how much fun it is to open the refrigerator and find a colored egg.
And if you want to go to church, if you're a religious family, go to church. But have some fun with your kids at the same time so that they'll think religion is fun as well.
Yes, and there's so much to be said for a child's fantasy, be it Easter or anything else.
This has been Examine Life.
The KKRN 88.5 FM, Bella Vista.
I'm Steve.
And I'm Pat.
And we hope you've enjoyed the show.
Thank you, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.